Welcome to Impacting the Classroom, the podcast where you can listen to dynamic interactions among educators, policymakers, and researchers who are making an impact in education. I'm Arnetta Larimer.
And I'm Darlene Estes Del Rey, and we're excited to have these conversations about the big topics happening in education that are impacting the classroom. Today's episode, we'll talk more broadly about these topics, and then in the season of the podcast, we're going to dive deeper into each of these topics.
I don't know about you, Darlene, but I am really excited to just jump right in and start discussing these themes. But first, I want to introduce our guest. Suzanne Morris is the Senior Director of Public Policy and Government Relations. She was most recently a senior fellow with the Bipartisan Policy Center Early Childhood Initiative and served as the Deputy Secretary for the Pennsylvania Office of Child Development and Early Learning. Welcome, Suzanne. We also have Dr. Veronica Fernandez. She's our Senior Director of Social Impact here at Teachstone. She is new in this role, but not new to Teachstone. She's also been working as a consultant to us here for many years and has a lot of familiarity with the class measures and our entire continuous quality improvement system. She was most recently at the University of Miami, where she was leading research to understand and improve the quality of early learning experiences and promote equity for culturally, linguistically, and racially diverse children. Welcome, both of you. I'm like so excited to have some conversations with you guys today. So let me kick it off. In this unpredictable time for so many children and families, what is the one opportunity you're seeing for education to better meet their needs?
Well, I'm happy to take that question first. I think in this incredibly challenging time for all communities, education really has an opportunity to put children and families at the center, and to be entirely responsive to their needs in a very meaningful way. And we're seeing that happen across the board. And I know we're going to dive deeper in today's conversation and the ways that's happening, but that is really what's making me excited right now in this very challenged time, is that there is just a lot of opportunity to put families at the center.
I mean, they should be, right? That's why we do the work that we do, building those foundations. Did you want to add anything?
I think that we're also seeing the conversation really rise in terms of the importance of early childhood. Mm-hmm. It's grabbed hold in a really new way. It's definitely risen in prominence in the national conversation. We see everyone from the chair of the Treasury Department putting out statements around the importance of accessing early learning to business community members speaking very directly with their employees and their communities around what it means to be able to holistically support their employees with early learning access. So really pushing early education to the forefront as an essential service is a good that's come out of the pandemic, and something that I think that we can just continue to drive forward in the national conversation as well as in our own local communities.
All right. So let's talk about just some key things. We're just going to touch on them, right? These are episodes in themselves. So we're just going to give them a kiss today. Let's talk about the drive for equity. What does equity in early childhood education mean to you? Let's start with you, Ms. Veronica.
Sure. Equity essentially means that everyone has access to what they need when they need it so that they can develop and actualize their full potential. And this is different from equality because equal supports assumes equal needs and equal starting points, and that's not our reality. What we want to equalize is access, ensuring that everyone has access to opportunities, to high quality experiences, and providing equitable learning opportunities also means that we recognize and value the unique assets of individuals and build from them. Culture, language, abilities, experiences, these are assets that provide richness to classrooms and interactions. And we achieve equity as an educational system when someone's race, their ethnicity, their home language, their demographic characteristics essentially don't predict differences in outcomes.
Wonderful. You want to unpack some pieces, right? Like perhaps give us a nice concrete example of what you mean by that last statement.
Sure. In an inequitable education system, which is our current reality, if we have a set of child level outcome data and we look at the distribution of data at the highest and lowest ends, we can likely predict with some confidence who the children are at the low end of performance, right? Mm-hmm. Children who are Black, Indigenous, Latino, DLLs, children experiencing poverty. Mm-hmm. Similarly, on the other end of performance, we can predict that those children on the highest end are likely white and from affluent families, right? So when we can no longer make those predictions and race, ethnicity, demographic characteristics are not driving differences in outcomes, that's when we're confident that we've achieved equity.
I love that example. And you can't see me, but I'm like literally nodding my head. My head's almost falling off with agreement for, you know, with what you're saying. I want to piggyback on what you said about accessibility, because that, you know, a big deal. And when we think about the pandemic, right, and the fact that so many students went into virtual learning, accessibility was something that wasn't initially thought of, right? It was just like, we will just have them learn from home. But we didn't think about, you know, do they have internet access, right? If their parents are now working at home, are they able to access, you know, and have the bandwidth to do the work? Do they have the technology to be successful? So that added another barrier that we didn't really think about, you know, in an equitable fashion.
And that's exactly right. When we think about equity only in terms of children's outcomes, we end up perpetuating disparities, right? We end up focusing on stereotypes and putting blame on individuals, like the families who can't do for their child and can't support the child's learning, the child who's not showing up for virtual learning, or the child is not showing up for school because they don't have options for shift care and so forth. And it makes us unintentionally do harm when we highlight mm-hmm. these deficits and struggles and challenges. So we spend a lot of time trying to fix people, children, families, teachers. We have to shift our understanding of equity and inequities to be about access to resources, yes. to opportunities, to quality of experiences. And then we get a much more comprehensive understanding about the why and how people differ in their outcomes and performance, right? When we think about those as the root causes, then we can start focusing on fixing programs, policies, practices that mm-hmm. perpetuate the inequities that lead to the disparities in outcomes, right? And yes. we can focus our shared energy and resources on removing those barriers, as you said, Marnetta, rather than wondering what's taking someone so long to get over mm-hmm. the barrier, or expecting right. a certain group of people to just jump a little higher to get over those barriers.
Right. Because I have the axe. I don't know what the problem is, right? So it's, you know, also stepping outside of, you know, your norm and just realizing people are in different places, right? And how can I help those people get to where I am? Thank you so much. So still talking about equity, how do you see equity showing up currently in the field of early childhood education? Suzanne?
So it's showing up in myriad ways. And I think the conversation really is iterative and evolving and continuing. But initially, as equity has emerged as a very hot topic, we're really seeing it coalesce around the workforce and our teachers that are in our classrooms. And in thinking about the policies that support those teachers, who's at the policy table, I think, is one way that we're seeing it show up in the early childhood field, starting to build feedback loops and bridges of opportunity to allow those that are providing direct care in our classrooms to be at the policy tables and a part of the conversation with the decision makers that do everything from set the terms and definitions of what quality is in early learning to determining the funding levels for everything from childcare subsidy to the professional development systems that support our early education workforce. So I think there's just a very strong drive across policymakers right now to think about pushing everything through a lens of equity, because we know that our workforce is mostly comprised of women. It's around 92% female-led, and that it is also made up of a large portion of women of color. And so for too long, those folks have not had their voices heard and have not been at the policy tables where these big decisions get made that set up the systems that drive the entire field. So I think that's one way that we are starting to see equity emerge when it comes to the workforce. And we're hoping that that conversation will continue to accelerate as we move forward with the significant amount of funding that's coming down from the federal level and getting to the states right now to create stabilization in this very fragile environment that mm-hmm. early learning is set in right now.
Yeah, we're going to talk more about that in a little bit, because that's a whole nother conversation as well. You were mentioning, you know, these seats at the policy table. As we see these conversations happen, is there anybody that you were hoping would show up that hasn't shown up at the table, you know, that you think would be impactful, that you're just waiting for them to arrive and yeah. share their voice?
Well, I think the early childhood field is ready to arrive. It's whether or not the mechanisms have been built into those policy tables to allow them to be heard. The sector that I often think about that's been not included as often is really family childcare or home-based yes. providers. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very challenging for them. Often they're working, you know, they're operating solely. They may not have a lot of supports. If those conversations are happening at 2 p.m. on a Wednesday and there's no way to get to that table other than being in person, then that is not an equitable environment for our workforce in any way, shape, or form. And we've seen this shift to families really appreciating and choosing home-based childcare mm-hmm. in this, you know, a very challenging health environment with the pandemic. So I think it's important now more than ever that they are at the table. And that's a place that I'm really hoping that our policymakers start to show up in pushing forward with practices that allow those voices to be heard. I do think that, you know, our associations that represent our early learning workers and our mm-hmm. childcare providers, and they're very much at the table and making sure that they're as inclusive as possible to all of their members. I think that's there's a real capacity need there in yeah. terms of making sure that they have everything to draw from the field. I know they've been working really hard over the past 18 to 24 months that we've been in yeah. this environment, but there's just so much going on, and it's really a quickly, rapidly changing environment in terms of policy that they're spread pretty thin. So, yeah. We want to make sure that they have as much opportunity as possible to communicate with all their members and bring that back to the policy tables.
Yeah, you're right. It is a challenge, right? Because while all of these people are in the meetings and doing their work, we're holding it down, right? The children have mm-hmm. to be somewhere, right? And so I can't come to the meeting because I've got your children. I'm caring for them, loving on them, you know, helping them to learn and building that foundation, right? And so it's hard to go to the meetings that are integral to my being, right? And, you know, the work that I do, because I'm working. there's nothing else for do, especially family childcare, who, like you said, if you're by yourself, you know, you don't have a sub or anybody to fill in so that you can make those kind of meetings to help to support your field. Let's talk about some challenges in the workforce. So, you know, we've been in this pandemic for a moment, you know, it's been quite a while. And there's been this real shift in how people look at work and a lot of challenges that have been brought to the workforce. So let's talk about the Great Resignation and how it's impacted the field of early childhood. So, you know, in August, 4.3 million people resigned from their work, like their jobs. They were just like, deuces, I'm out, right? How has that impacted our field?
Oh, it's impacting it in an enormous way. It's almost impossible to capture in my mind of where we're at right now in this moment in time. Early childhood is as much a part of this very challenged working environment as many other professions. And we're seeing that show up in many different ways. We have a whole chunk of early childhood teachers who, for whatever reason, during the pandemic, left the field and have not returned. And we're also seeing fewer people choosing to enter the field of early learning and selecting that as their career choice and putting themselves on that career pathway. And the reasons are really, I mean, it's, you know, it's a ton of reasons. It's not just one single reason, But we do know, first and foremost, that the early childhood workforce is deeply underpaid. And that shows up in the labor data that shows us early childhood being at the 2% bottom of all professional fields in terms of compensation. It's around $12 an hour, even with a four-year degree. We know that we have a pretty highly degreed workforce. I think there's a misconception out there around the early childhood workforce.
Absolutely.
The data show that for center-based programs, about 53% of the field holds some type of degree, whether it's a two-year degree or a four-year degree. And then at least another third has some college credit. So essentially, our society has set the bar really high and said, we expect you to achieve these professional achievements. And they've gone out and done that. And unfortunately, our system has not awarded them the recognition that they deserve through wages and compensation. But there's also an environmental factor that's happening here. Obviously, early learning is very much a place-based, interaction-led environment. We really want that for our children. We want them to have face-to-face interactions that are deep and meaningful. But that means that stressors that happen in an early learning classroom when there aren't enough hands on deck, right, and when there isn't enough capacity and there aren't enough materials because there's maybe not enough funding in the system, is really creating very stressful, inflexible environments for our teachers. And they are not always necessarily getting the wraparound supports, it's what I call it, that mental health, that behavioral health support that they need to flourish in the classroom so they can really be the best teacher for those kiddos day to day. And that is deeply inequitable. And that's something that absolutely needs to be addressed today and moving forward.
Yeah. Do you think that we are on the verge of taking a step backwards, right? Because if you think about this resignation, people are at home, they're not working, which means they're probably not taking their children to, you know, early childhood settings so that they can get what they need, what we know they need in order to thrive and be successful in school. Do you think that, you know, we're kind of taking a step back in, you know, how people view the importance of early childhood, because we've made so much gain over the last few years? Do you think that we're going to be losing importance?
I think the sands are shifting in multiple ways. So before I came to teach Stone, I was with BPC, and at BPC, we did a series of longitudinal parent surveys over the entire course of the pandemic. And what we were able to identify in those surveys is that parents' preferences are really changing right now in terms of both their work preferences. We're seeing a lot of push for a lot more flexibility, the ability to be able to work from home at least part of the week, and then just the flexibility around working hours and what it means to have a full working week. And that impacts how often parents might choose to use an early learning program, because they may want to have their kids closer to them for part of the week, just to have that experience of having them in a home environment, or for whatever reasons. But I think at the same time, we are seeing a lot more recognition that parents are deeply appreciative of the early learning access that they do have or had before the pandemic. So it's sort of like moving in two directions at once. Mm-hmm. And I don't think anything's really settled yet. That's my sense of it, is that it's very much an evolution at this point in time. And until we get to a place where we feel like we know what parents want and need, we already know what children deserve, that will help us understand how the field will be shaped, just in terms of supply. When I think about what we need for actual slots and places for children to go on a daily or part week basis.
Thank you so much. When I think about challenges in the workforce, you know, and even talking about the, you know, people being at home with their children not in early learning settings, I also think about the trauma of this whole thing, right? Which is also a challenge that's brought to teachers that they might not be prepared for as well, right? They have their own stressors, right? With their dealings of the pandemic and what's happening to them and their families and their challenges. And now they have children showing up, right? Who are traumatized, like they've been disconnected, they've been isolated. We don't know what's happening with their families and how they were supported during this process. So give me some thoughts on that.
I can speak briefly to that, but I don't I don't have a lot of expertise in that area. I will say that definitely mental health consultation models have to be amplified in response to the pandemic. It was needed before the pandemic. We needed to provide more comprehensive supports for children, for families, for teachers, for educators who are doing this work every single day. But now in the midst of this pandemic, it's absolutely critical. And hand in hand with mental health supports, I think a driving factor in teachers resigning is lack of comprehensive health care, right? Childcare workers are not offered healthcare. So they're going into programs, risking their lives. Interactions are critical, right? They don't have the luxury of working from home. They don't have the luxury of working remotely or keeping 6 foot distance. I don't know if you've ever tried to keep 6 feet away from a toddler. It's just not possible, right? It's physically impossible. And children, you know, can't keep their masks on all day. It's not expected. It's actually not recommended. So they would literally be risking their lives. And I think a lot of individuals just took inventory and said, I can't do this. I don't have healthcare. I don't have a retirement plan. I don't have something to fall back on. I have to think about my own survival in this. Right. So I think that would be a driving factor. And, you know, we, in our own local work that we've done at the University of Miami, we found that teachers were just as likely as Head Start families to be experiencing poverty, to report food insecurity, right? They're not paid a worthy wage. They're experiencing poverty. We know that nationally teachers are underpaid and our workforce is predominantly women and women of color. And, you know, teachers who are Black, Indigenous, people of color, they make even less than teachers who are white, who already are not making a worthy wage, right? So I think all of those things combined was a recipe for disaster. Our early childhood system was fragile to begin with. And we saw that it could not withstand the weight of the pandemic. Most industries couldn't, right? And essentially one that didn't have this kind of infrastructure.
Thank you. Does anybody else want to add to that? I see everybody they're giving me this look, like there's so much, right? It's a lot to unpack and to really think about. It's kind of saddening too, right? Like hurts my heart even thinking about it. So a lot of the things that we talked about were tied to, there was a common thread, funding. So Darlene, you want to talk about funding and have this conversation?
Yeah. So when I think about our hearts being in a heavy place and I think about the needs of children and families and those teachers and educators who have been just the champions during this pandemic, and they've been, you know, they've been on the front lines and they've been trying to figure it out with so little resources, so little support, as you all have lifted up. And so my curiosity is really thinking about this one-time funding. We hear a lot of phrases being tossed around like this, the moment's now. Time is here. We need to change the systems that are set up to produce the results that they are doing. And so if we keep doing things the same way that we always have, it's not going to change. So what can we do in this moment now with this funding, whether it's the American Rescue Plan Act, maybe it's the stabilization grants, maybe it's the increased funding Head Start has received, or any others that you are thinking of? What can leaders think about? What would you like to see leaders do differently or with this one-time funding that could really move us forward in these spaces of whether it's workforce development you're thinking about, equity of programs? I think about, you know, equity lens from my former role. I used to always frustrate me to think about, like, we gave the same amount of funding to every program. Every program didn't need the same amount of funding. In fact, so many needed much more than they ever got. They got the least, but needed the most for various reasons. So just want to throw that out there. We have an opportunity to make a difference. And what would you see as maybe, what would you like leaders to do or think about with the use of those funds? And so, Veronica, it looks like you are ready to kick this off.
I'm ready. So with the American Families Plan, it's a strategic investment that's focused particularly on supporting children and families. And I think a lot of those aspects of funding are targeted to supporting children and families, but I think it has the potential to bridge the opportunity gap. I'm particularly interested in one aspect of that investment, which is universal preschool. And the Children's Equity Project recently put out a brief in which they outlined how Head Start could and should serve as a model for universal preschool in our country. We don't have the time to get into all the details now, but I highly encourage everyone and policymakers especially to read it. And maybe we can link the report with the podcast recording. But essentially, to be effective, the universal pre-K system has to be comprehensive. It has to focus on the whole child, the whole family, and supporting educators. It's going back to what you were saying, Darlene and Suzanne, where this will roll in the focus on equity, on workforce development, wraparound services, mental health, healthcare. It's really a comprehensive way for us to support children, families, and educators. And Head Start is not perfect, but at its core, it has all of the components that children, families, and educators need and deserve. And a universal expansion of Head Start is what I would really like to see. And when I say pre-K, and when I say Head Start, when I say pre-K, I'm talking about early Head Start to an infant and toddler care, especially.
Veronica, just for some listeners who may not be as fluent in the understanding of what universal pre-K is, can you expand on that a little bit and what universal pre-K is? So that way they can kind of wrap themselves around what you just said.
Yeah, it hasn't been fully defined yet. And I think that's the opportunity that we have with these funds, right? But essentially, it's about providing childcare to all, right? And you know, when we initially think about universal pre-K, so everyone having access to pre-K that's being subsidized by our government, there's a little bit of concern and hesitation around equity, but I actually see it as an opportunity to expand and strengthen equitable learning systems, right? Head Start is only serving a fraction of eligible families. So expanding access to Head Start for eligible families is step one, right? And then it's all eligible families, right? Serving more eligible families than all eligible families, and then continued expansion of eligibility. Families and children in marginalized communities have to be prioritized. Those experiencing poverty have to be prioritized. So it's going to take some time, but the eventual goal is that all children are, you know, have access to high quality childcare and education environments before they start formal schooling in kindergarten, right? That's the ultimate goal.
Thank Veronica, you. We're so excited because this is one of the topics that we are looking forward to digging so deep into in a future episode. So we know there's great interest. And so we definitely think this is worthy of bringing folks on board to talk more about. But I wanted to kick it over to Suzanne and to just hear your thoughts. Like this one, here we are, the moment's now. We heard Veronica, great thoughts. What would you want leaders to do or think about with this one-time funding?
So I would love, I mean, I have a whole list. I came with the scroll, but the one thing I would love to see our policymakers take on at this moment in time is we trust our children in early childhood settings every day. We put them in the hands of adults that we trust to teach our children, to allow them to interact with their peers, to develop in a healthy way. I would like to see policies that embrace that same level of trust, because I think when you have trust in your system, then you start to build stability. And one concrete example that I can give around this is childcare programs are most often reimbursed for services that they delivered in a prior period of time. That creates a lot of unpredictability because, and sometimes it's tied to how often a child is actually physically in a program. I would like to see policymakers start to look at giving contracts right up front for payments so that programs have a predictable funding stream so that they know what they have for the next 6 months to a year in terms of being able to serve very vulnerable populations, including their own teachers that are in their classroom, to Veronica's point. I think that when you start to trust the field as the professionals that they are and that they have shown themselves to be, we will start to have a system that is stable enough that we can have access for more families, for more children. I think the other thing I would love to see is for our policymakers, as we look ahead to any potential increased funding opportunities through the conversations that are happening in Congress, is an adherence and commitment to a mixed delivery system. I do really want to respect the field for where it is today and not think that we have to throw the baby out with the bathwater. I don't love that saying, but to have to start all over again and develop a whole new system without recognizing all of the professionals that are in the system right now would be a real loss to all of our communities. I know that's an understatement, but when we talk about universal pre-K, Head Start expansion, increasing childcare funding, let's use the providers and programs that we have already in the system that have dedicated their lives and their careers to ensuring our children and families are best positioned for a happy, healthy future, and not start all over again. And I think that is a concern shared by many. And I do think that we can get there, but I just want to continue to drive that point forward every opportunity I get.
I totally agree, Suzanne. And I think that that's partially why the early Head Start childcare partnerships were so successful, because they didn't look to establish new centers that were run by the grantee, but rather partnering with existing childcare programs within the communities where there was the greatest need and helping to uplift their quality, right? So bringing those partners, those childcare programs as partners to the table to make some decisions to start to implement the Head Start performance standards within their existing programs to ensure that there was infrastructure to their buildings that not only benefited the one or two early Head Start classrooms in that program, but everybody. So, you know, the children got a new playground, the building was made more safe, there were improvements made to the structure of the building, there was diapers for all the children in the classroom, and that mixed delivery model where it wasn't necessarily just allocated to the children who were eligible for early Head Start. So there is room for building from existing systems and frameworks that work while partnering with the programs who are in the communities doing this work year after year.
Veronica, that's a perfect segue to my next kind of question, was because I was thinking, like, we have these three big topics we've been kind of broadly speaking on, you know, thinking about the funding opportunities, you know, the equity piece and thinking about workforce development and then bringing it back to the impact of the classroom. And so you just did that for us. You said, like, what does it really look like? Like the even more diapers. I mean, that's a tangible change, like a real thing that we can see evidence of. Are we any better than we were? And so I pose that to you as just one more thought before I kick it back over to Marnetta. But I, like, if you were talking to leaders and you're still thinking about what you hope leaders will do or what you'd like to see, if you had to finish a sentence that said, I would like to see, or I'm excited about leaders because they can do this for impact in the classroom in a way that we'll know that we're better off than we were today or even before the pandemic, what might that be? And I know that's a loaded question, but as you're thinking about something you didn't share, like what is it that you think that if leaders did this or thought about this, we definitely would see that impact in the classroom?
I would come back to engaging families. So I think anything that we do in early childhood education has to circle back to empowering, positioning families to really be driving the decisions that we're making. So providing them with comprehensive supports by ways of social services, sure, but also bringing them into the classrooms, respecting them and their funds of knowledge as being contributors of richness to the interactions and experiences that are having in the classroom. So I think when we think about impact, there's only so much time we have with children when we have them in early care and education settings, right? They're going to transition. There's been a lot of criticisms around Head Start, for example. Clearly, I'm a big proponent of Head Start, right? I keep coming back to that. But some of the criticisms around Head Start is, well, you know, these kids go into elementary schools and then they're not necessarily better off than the children who didn't experience Head Start. And, you know, Head Start is not a medical inoculation model. There's a lot of talk about the COVID vaccine, right? It's not a vaccination. It's not something that's going to inoculate the child from the effects of poverty moving forward. So when they go into elementary schools that are under-resourced, that don't have the comprehensive set of services, it's not going to continue to have its intended effects. But if we are working more intentionally with families, if we're empowering them, hopefully these families are going to continue to be in the children's lives forever, right? And so if we could do more there in that space, I think it's a way to bubble children up a little bit more and protect them for longer as they go through school and through life.
Yeah, so it sounds like pushing up those great family engagement and wraparound services from Head Start model all the way through the grades, because the families go with them the whole way through their education and their life. So I love that. Suzanne, wanted to give you an opportunity to kind of fill in the blanks for that statement that impacting classroom, what would you like to see?
Actually, I want to like mold that question, because I agree, Darlene, I want to talk about impact in the classroom. And we've talked a lot about, you know, giving teachers what they need and making sure the families are good. Like, how can we also help the teachers? Like, how can we impact the classroom from a teacher perspective to make them either better prepared, like, right? Like, so talk to me about that, Suzanne.
Yeah, I think we touched on it briefly, but I would love to see our leaders really prioritize accessible career pathways mm-hmm. that meet our field where it's at. Now, that's definitely a magic wand statement. I know it doesn't necessarily work that way, but we really need to recognize that our field carries a wealth of knowledge on child development, on children's and families' needs holistically across the board. And so we need to be able to capture that in a way that it shows up in workforce development strategies and meets what we see at the other end of the spectrum, which is this professionalization push. I'm sort of still in this area where I don't necessarily think every teacher needs to hold a degree to be considered a professional in this field. Right. I know there's some disagreement there out there nationally, but I happen to be one of those ones that has had amazing experiences, both anecdotally with my own family and then seen it from a policy position, that we do have very knowledgeable folks out there. Mm-hmm. But I want to see them recognized in the system as the professionals that they are.
Yes.
And I also, for those that are starting to think about entering the workforce, that are starting to really say, hey, this is the career option for me, I want that to be a true career pathway. And so that may mean getting on the job training that is provides meaningful content and builds up competencies, accessibility to higher education that isn't like reading Greek, that right. they have the navigators and the coaching and the mentoring and system supports that they need to be able to enter into higher education if that's their chosen pathway. So I would really like to see systems come into a place where they're much more flexible and accessible, and it's not set in this one size fits all of a 4-year degree. That's just not where the world is at anyway anymore. I think for many, many professions, including early childhood, and we deserve to have that same ability to be able to let our leaders and our teachers develop and thrive within a learning environment for themselves. In addition to all those wonderful things that Veronica talked about that they deserve to have as well, access to healthcare, mm-hmm. paid time off, mental health supports, behavioral health access. I mean, they deserve it. I mean, as much as any other professional at this point in time. So I think the opportunity is very rich. We are seeing some movement here and there, and states are primed to start developing these systems. So we're really here to encourage them and be a thought partner with any of our folks that we work with at the state or community level. We're very much here to help them think that through from TeachNotes' perspective.
I love that, Suzanne. I live in Louisiana, and I know with our funding many years back, one of the drivers, like, we wanted to legitimize the field, right? So our childcare providers are able to get educated for free, right? Whether it's an ancillary certification, you know, with the CDA program, going to college, right? They really want to provide those supports for them and remove that barrier that, you know, and give them access to a higher level of education so that they can feel like the professionals that we already know that they are. And they also get, you know, based on, you know, their drive, right? They get an incentive, right? In the way of bonuses, right? So really supporting, you know, and being able to drive their own growth, right? And they really have that in their own pockets, but it's benefiting and it's changed the scope of our early learning systems here in Louisiana immensely.
Marnetta, I really appreciate you using the word legitimize the field, because that feels very asset-based, where it's, you know, recognizing them for what they've already accomplished, versus a lot of times we hear about professionalizing the workforce, which is often pushed by this need to have degreed professionals, right, leading in classrooms. So I really appreciate that distinction. I think we could do more around that. And I just want to say one thing. I know you asked us each for one, but we talked about families, we talked about career pathways, and I just want to make a plug for the importance of leaders. And when I say leaders, of course, I mean policymakers and so forth, but I'm also talking about the leaders who are within programs in family childcare homes or directors and owners of schools, because if we could do more there, I think that we can have a true impact. If we really round it out with those three priorities and we're ensuring that leaders are building up teachers in their interactions every single day, engaging in parallel process, right? So the things that we want teachers to engage in with children, those same interactions and those same practices, seeing that happening in schools as the school culture, I think is extremely critical.
Thank you for adding that.
Great. And Araneta, we're ready for you to wrap us. It's hard to believe our time goes so quickly on this episode. We could just talk for hours.
This is over? I'm not ready. So we shared a lot of things here, right? We talked about funding, what we would like to see happen in the field. We talked about equity, our understanding of equity, you know, making sure that it's not only just access, you know, across the board, but being intentional about what that looks like and giving people opportunities to be at the same level as their cohort or people that they are working with or in the classroom with. We talked about how the decline in the workforce has impacted our field. And we really only touched on a lot of these just very briefly. Sounded like a lot, but it really was just a touch on each of those topics. We also talked about what we would like to see happen, right? When we're talking about policies, seats at the tables, and that's across all settings, whether it be Head Start, family childcare, public pre-K, private early learning centers. And there's so much work to do, and we've done a lot, right? So nice, broad discussion, definitely just a footprint in a larger picture. And we're going to have a lot more to discuss over the course of this podcast series. So I'm really excited about just jumping in and really dissecting each of those pieces. Because if it's any implication of what we did today, it's going to be amazing and very impactful and things that people really want to hear and can pull from. I want to thank our guests, Veronica Fernandez and Suzanne Morris, for your insights and your time today. You guys were incredible. Thank you so much. It was wonderful talking with you. We'll post the transcription and related resources on our site, teachstone.com/impacting. See you next episode when we dig into equity. Remember, behind great leading and teaching are powerful interactions. Let's build that culture together.